The following is presented by the Earth Angel Media Network.
What if most of what you think is true is not? Or what if what many call fact is patently false? How would your life change if you discovered that most of history was rewritten to control how we think and how we live today? Is it possible that by simply daring to ask intelligent, unbiased questions, we can save our world from controlled destruction? It's been said that knowing the truth will set us free. Are you ready to taste freedom? Perhaps for the first time? Welcome to Studio 17. We question everything, then do it again and again. You arrived at Studio 17 by intention, not by accident. Studio 17 is hosted by Dr. Tia Jolie Phillips, a former Air Force pilot, a doctor of holistic health, and now world entrepreneur and ambassador for freedom. Question everything. Rinse. Repeat. You are in the perfect place at the perfect time. Studio 17 starts
right now.
Welcome, everybody. I want to welcome my guest, Mike King. He's calling. I think you're in New York City right now, Mike, or are you traveling?
No, in the orbit of New York City, in North New Jersey.
Awesome. Yeah. For those of you who don't know Mike, you're about to be in for a treat here, because I've got a list of about 50 people that I wanted to have on my show. I whittled it down to the top 10, and I went through a friend of mine, call out to Charles Frohman, who connected us, because I told Charles I really want to get a hold of this guy. For those of you who don't know, Mike King is extremely in demand right now. The information that he puts out there answers so many questions. But the thing is, most people are not asking the questions. So my hope today is that by introducing Mike to you, we can find out a little bit about him, but at the same time, get inside of the mind, the inquisitive mind of Mike King, because you can't really appreciate his works. You can't really comprehend the value of all of his publications unless you comprehend what sort of questions he asked getting into it. So I don't want to take much time because he's very limited with me tonight, but I do want to just start off, Mike, by thanking you for being here. I appreciate you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm happy to speak to a little different audience going beyond the echo chamber here. And hopefully we could intrigue some people.
Yeah. And this is actually episode one. It's airing on Earth Angel Media Network. The Earth Angel Media Network is a good news network. And the idea is that, you know, we're kind of turning a corner here. There's most of us, like through our whole lives for decades now, have lived through some dastardly things, all sorts of lies and cheating and stealing and things like that. Yeah. And so I get the sense at an intuitive level, but also based on my intelligence, things I'm researching myself, that we might be turning a corner. But one thing we don't want to do is retrace the negative things we've been through. So it's really important, I think, from our world that we take a look at where we've been, not where the media, the corporate media tells us we've been, not where the textbooks tell us we've been, but actually where we've actually been. And this is why I wanted you to be on board on today's episode. This is episode one. I'm going to do episode zero in a couple of days, but I felt that you were such a priority. I wanted to have you on first. For those of you listening, Mike's very in demand. You can hear him on so many different channels. And most of those would probably get through his website. We'll talk about that at the very end. The goal of Studio 17 moving forward is to get people to ask questions. So this is the basis of us talking to Mike today, is to ask questions. What you're going to find is that everybody's got opinions. Everybody's got beliefs. But you can only have opinions and beliefs in the absence of truth. You can't have a belief if you know the truth, because then you know the truth. You don't need the belief anymore. So a belief is a stepping stone on your way to truth. So I invited Mike, because there's a lot of people that have beliefs, but what you're going to find is that as Mike goes through this information, which is very relevant to the 9/11 today, you're going to find his mind is very solid, very logical. You're going to find his methods are very, very, almost as if he's an attorney. So I'm very excited for you to learn this stuff. But before I dive into your content, Mike, I want you to tell people a little bit about you. Your biography was just so brief. Like, I know that you're from New York City. You're a city boy. You've got those, the city instincts, you know, things like that. But tell us a little more about you as a person. You characterize yourself as tenacious. You've mentioned that you're, if you were to be reincarnated, or I'm sorry, you said it, if Sherlock Holmes was reincarnated, that would be you, you know?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Well, actually, I was born and raised in the vicinity of New York, in the New York metro area, New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey, third largest city in New Jersey. So certainly I grew up with ample amount of street smart, city boy instincts, I say. But I also had, since childhood, and I guess you can relate to this, we were talking about it prior to the show, just like an innate ability since childhood to see something that doesn't fit and ask questions about it and never stop pulling on that thread until I get an answer. And that's more of an ability than it is a cultivated skill. But I did cultivate over the years, research skills, and there's a methodology to everything I write about. It's almost like, you mentioned an attorney. But attorneys can go the wrong way on a bad side of the case, too. I would say more like a mathematician, only with facts and just simplifying things, which is the whole essence of mathematics. You're taking something complex, boil it down until you get to the final simple equation and solve for X. And that's really my specialty, is to take things that are seemingly complex and just boil them down to the most essential elements and then present them in such a way that anybody can come up the learning curve almost instantly. So there's not a lot of fluff or unnecessary verbiage in any of my work. All of my, whether it's my articles or my many books, it's always the same template. Clear, concise, brief, lots of images with captions. So it sticks and it makes sense. And I think one of the reasons, putting aside all false modesty, that I've become quite popular is because of this. People say, oh, I get it now. No one ever explained it. I wish I had a history teacher like you, et cetera. And my website is realnewsandhistory.com, and the two go together. My website's motto is, fake history is the fake news that has passed into the rearview mirror. And unless somebody is comatose by now, I think most folks have figured out that the news is fake, or there's a lot of fakery in it. But one has to realize is once a fake storyline is embedded in the public mind and time passes, it's no longer fake news. It's what? It's fake history. So this problem that has afflicted humanity, it didn't begin in the last 5 years, 10 years. It didn't begin after 9/11. It goes back more than a century, two centuries. There was fake news, believe it or not. I'm being sarcastic. Why should it be so hard to believe? There was fake newspapers 150 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, which means everything has got to be revisited. And I call myself a correctionist historian. I like to go back and see, okay, there's a decimal point missing here. This equation's, and then you have to correct it. Because if you don't understand the past, there's no way you can understand the present day. So I weave the two together, and the history comes to life, and it gives one a much better understanding and appreciation of events that are unfolding today. And that gets really powerful and it can be life-changing. And many people have told me that my work is life-changing because it's like it's taking the blinders off. Because these blinders have been put over our eyes since childhood through the education system and also and then reinforced through the fake news. So that's what I do. It's real news and history. And as far as my own journey, I graduated Rutgers. I was a business major and worked in that world up until about 13 years ago when I made this a full-time endeavor. And since that time, it's just been full-time writing and research. And then even 20 years prior to that, it was always something I was aware of and studied. But only when you dive into not only world affairs of the present, but also the history, when you dive into it on a full-time basis, you really appreciate how badly we've all been deceived, lied to, and the popular term these days is gaslighted.
So, Mike, I was going to ask you about that because we're in a place where there's so much information. It's almost like white noise. There's a lot of static. And you can change channels on, I don't even have TV anymore, but you can change channels and all of the stories are different. They seem to be coming together or coalescing with some degree of synchronicity now. But still, how do you, like you mentioned in your biography, again, a short one, you have a disdain for what's called conventional wisdom. Yeah. How do you build the intuition? Like part of being a Sherlock Holmes, like you are for history, is this intuition or kind of being able to cut through what's true and what's false. How did you cultivate that? Was that something you were born with or how did you get there?
I would compare it to like, say a great athlete like Michael Jordan. Okay. He's blessed to be 6'7" and a lean athletic build, but he was also a psycho in the gym, a tireless work ethic. So right. The two go together. So yes, I have these abilities, which I don't know if you're born with it or they're the result of childhood experiences. I was much younger than my older siblings, youngest kid on the block. I spent a lot of alone time where I had to entertain myself. So maybe that cultivated something. But I was always seeing things that didn't fit and recognizing this doesn't fit. Why is that? And you're just good with puzzles and stuff like that. I relate to the character in My Cousin Vinny. Joe Pesci plays the attorney. He doesn't seem like the sharpest knife in the drawer, but man, he can see things into it. And he puts on such a performance in the courtroom and everyone's amazed. So you either have that or you don't. But then you couple that with the full-time research and then certain skills are acquired over time and a methodology of, I never accept a data point unless I know it's solid. Okay. And one of the things about Sherlock Holmes, by the way, I used to love his novels when I was a kid, the short stories, I used to read them all. And they had the old Basil Rathbone episodes on TV. But he would show up at a crime scene and all these by the book detectives from Scotland Yard, they thought they had it all figured out. And he has such a disdain and a contempt for them. They're trying to explain, well, here's what it looks like. He didn't even want to know. He didn't care. It's like, I just want data. Don't give me your conjectures yet. Let's get the data first. And I really relate to that because I see too many people, they just base their belief systems and opinions on things that are not part of the logical equation, such as authority. Well, he's an authority, okay? Somebody speaks like that doesn't mean anything. It's only data that matters. Or this is the consensus. I hate that word. This is the popular opinion. Right. If you look deeply at what, and even if people go within themselves and ask themselves, why do I believe what I believe? If they're honest, they'll come to find out in short order that the reason they believe what they believe is because of authority figures telling them that, or peer pressure, okay, or never being exposed to another possibility. Very seldom do people arrive at a conclusion just based on the data, just collect it all and then sift through it. Says, okay, this isn't valid. This makes, and then put it together like the piece of a puzzle. So that's a skill that needs to be a little cultivated But once you get that down, I mean, quite frankly, I don't make mistakes. I mean, I might get a date wrong, okay, or a little fact wrong, but nothing elemental. And I simply don't, because, you know, I've got that down. And I'm not, this is where people need to get to. They should not at all be impacted by anybody who speaks authoritatively or confidently, including me. I speak that way because I feel I know what I'm right, but it doesn't matter. People have to get to the point where they can do the math on their own. Because if you're just going to look at somebody's so-called credentials and the way they speak, you're going to be misled more often than not.
So I've listened to so many of your interviews, which was one of the reasons that I wanted you on, but those things were very compelling to me. Number one, you're not going to take a position until you are solid with that position. I also observed that you're a very good listener. And I find a lot of people like you that are quieter and more observant and things, they actually have more to say. Because a lot of people that are just all up in your face and they're burping up these talking points and they're spewing out these narratives, it's a shallow game, because if you just push on them a little bit, they fall apart. But you're just the opposite. If somebody pushes you on you, you're like, well, no, actually, because you're like this, I should name you like Collier's or Britannica, like you're this encyclopedia. Yeah. But even then, those have been parsed and rewritten and things like that. You and I share a lot in common, but one of the things is we've both been censored a lot. You've been formally censored. You had books out there. You wrote, you know, about the bad war. Mm-hmm. Can you tell the listeners just a little bit about like your history with censorship? Because like you were on a major league hit list.
Yeah, that's right. I would say, well, in 2014, I had my first book self-published on Amazon, and that was called The War Against Putin. And I wrote that because I was so disgusted with the lies being told about Russia and Russia's intentions. And that caught the attention of Paul Craig Roberts, who was a nationally syndicated columnist, was a deputy editor to Wall Street Journal many years ago. He had a position deputy secretary at the Treasury in the Reagan administration. And he still writes now, but he had a pretty big circulated syndicated following. And he liked my book and he did a review on it and blew up on Amazon. And the way Amazon used to work back then is if you could generate a certain amount of sales on your own, which I did through my mailing list and then also through Paul Craig Roberts pushing my book, once the war on Putin blew up, then more people see it because it goes up the Amazon search engines. And then Amazon starts putting out emails to anybody who's looking in that category. Hey, you might want to check out this new book, etc. So then I saw that formula, and the next book I came out was the Planet Rothschild volumes. Then The Bad War, which is the true story of World War II. So 2014, 15, 16, 17, that was my heyday on Amazon. And early in 2017 is when Amazon began its reign of terror, its censorship reign. And I think this had a lot to do with the fact that the powers that be, they didn't see Donald Trump coming. And they were so confident in Hillary's victory. But then when it happened, they realized that the internet was a major factor in undermining their false narratives that they put out in the mainstream media. So the first wave of censorship was March 2017, and they removed the bad war. That one was particularly sensitive because World War II, I call it the foundational mythology that defines the modern world. If you go back and you correct that false history, the whole modern world changes. Just like a math equation, if you got the answer wrong, you have to go back to the original, figure out where'd you go wrong? Did you put a minus instead of a plus? Is the decimal point in the wrong way, et cetera? And then you correct that, you get a whole different answer. So that was a big blow to me because that was my all-time bestseller, The Bad War. It's still available at realnewsandhistory.com. And then there were other attacks. I had a PayPal account And at one time I had nearly 500 recurring small donors each month. They just killed it totally. Google started suppressing me and my work. It used to be if you put in certain subjects, my articles would show up in the top maybe two or three pages. Now you almost have to put the exact verbiage in order for me to register. I started a YouTube channel that was taken off. And it's always the same reason they cite violation of policies, hate speech. There's no hate. I don't preach any hate at all, except for the evildoers. Okay. But on a group level, it's like a race of people or ethnicity of people, you'll not find any of that in my work. I could see maybe how people might perceive that because of their conditioning. There's no calls to violence or anything like that. Yet I was in their crosshairs simply because not only because I present the truth, I think what really worries certain people is in the manner I present the truth. It's not a 1,000-page tome that only academics are going to read. Okay, I've got books here, like here's my 9/11 book. There's only 70 pages. It's meant to be read in an hour. Okay, large print illustrations. It's captivating. So it's not dumbed down. I always say I strive to be simple, being simplistic. This will provoke a lot of deep analysis and deep thinking. So it's not simplistic, but it's simple. And the simpler it is, the wider the audience one can reach and touch. And that's what scares them about my work.
So let's try to make up for some lost ground, because I see so much value in what you're doing that I want to ask my listeners to take what you've just said and just blow it up all over the world and just send it out, because we're at a place now where people are starving for the truth. Now, you sent me that book just now, that you sent it to me like this morning or last night. Mm-hmm. And I went through the whole thing, and so much there. Those, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen that book, we'll talk about it at the very end, but those books are available in hard copy, but also you have Mike's got a great deal on the PDFs too, on the eBooks or whatever they're called. But so Mike, thank you for your background and going into that. This is an anniversary today of 9/11. We're what, 23 years post 9/11. It's really just changed our world. And I believe we can change our world back if we go backwards in time. And let's talk about what really happened. Now, you sent me a document. If you give me one moment, I'm going to bring that up. And then if you would speak to the document, most of the people here are probably not familiar with anything but the official narrative. So this could be a kind of a shock to a lot of people. But I want to assure everybody that what Mike is sharing with you, I've been through the whole document. It's bulletproof. But also, following Mike, I've got other people. We've got architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. We've also got pilots for 9/11 Truth. These are people I've already talked to. So if you're, my goal is not to convince you of anything. My goal today is to get you asking simple questions, like, what if the official narratives are not correct? Because personally, I've personally never seen a narrative, an official narrative that was 100% true. In fact, it's almost just the opposite. I rarely see one that's mostly true. So with that said, let me go ahead and share my screen, Mike, and I'm just going to let you go. I want to honor your time because you have limited time today, but I really I really felt it important that people know, because yeah. Earth Angel Media is not about just the project. It's about the beautiful thoughts, the mind, because you don't have to do what you're doing. You're literally trying to save the world from repeating false history. I mean, this is one of the most novel, one of the most important things people can do is what you're doing. So I want to share this, and we'll talk later about how people can get their hands on this, but yeah. Very, very grateful to you for being here and sharing this information. So,
okay.
So I'm going to just let you go through.
All right. Well, the title is Crash Course 9/11 Inside Job. And this is available on Amazon. It's also at the website, but I prefer people pick it up on Amazon in order to help boost it up to search rankings. And my author page is Mike S. King. And the title again is Crash Course 9/11 inside job. Amazon is loosening up, by the way, in recent years.
So, Mike, what would you say to somebody that's triggered? Like, what do you mean inside job? I love America. They wouldn't lie to us. What do you say to those people?
Well, ask yourself the first question: as the government media complex ever lied to you in a big way? And if people say no, then I would follow up with, what about weapons of mass destruction? Now, there's one that's universally understood by now. Doesn't matter what your political persuasion is, if you voted for Bush or not, everyone knows that was a lie. There were no weapons of mass destruction. If people still believe think they are, then I think they're too far gone. You really can't even speak to those people. Okay, but that was a total media blitz. You got it from all the leaders of the Republican Party and the Democrat Party and the so-called liberal media and so-called conservative media. If you go back to those days, 2002, it's just presented as an established fact that a big bad Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, and he's going to pass them off to Osama bin Laden, and then he's going to use them on us. We got to go in. We have to go into Iraq. And then with all the passion and the emotion of those days, people didn't stop to think and reflect. They just accepted it. But probably by 2004, 2005, 2006, everyone understood that that was a lie. It was just a joke, a running joke. Okay. So there's one tangible precedent there. So don't tell me that we don't get lied to. All right. Well, someone would say, well, they wouldn't lie about something like this. Well, you know, that's called incredulity fallacy. And I caution people to steer clear of that. I talked earlier about accepting things on authority and accepting things on popularity. These are classic logical fallacies. Forget the authority figure. Forget what the consensus is. And don't ever get ensnared in incredulity fallacy either, where you say to yourself, oh, I would never do that. No, truth is stranger than fiction. I can tell you stuff that I've witnessed and experienced in my personal life. Okay.
Mike, I'm so glad you brought up personal fallacies and logical fallacies, because I actually have one of my episodes in the future is going to be specifically about logical fallacies. So thank you for bringing those up. That's a great segue.
It is. And there's a reason why they no longer teach even Aesop's fables in the elementary schools, because this is basic stuff. These are classic pitfalls of thinking that were articulated for us 2,000 years ago by the ancient Greeks and Romans. It's very, very simple stuff. And once you're aware of them, you won't get sidetracked by these fake arguments. These are all fake arguments they give us. Just look at the data, the hard data alone on a subject. And with 9/11, you might want to start with the fact three man-made mountains of concrete and steel. The two towers were turned into instant dust and aerosol within 10 seconds. Okay? And there's no rubble. There's not even a pile of rubble there at the floor. There's nothing there. It's almost like a David Copperfield magic trick. These mountains they literally turned into aerosol. Yeah. Okay. Stop and think how that happened. That's not the result of a pancake collapse. That's the word. That was the buzzword of the day. Pancakes. Remember that? Okay. So where's the bloody pancakes? They're not there. All I see is the powder coming out of the Aunt Jemima box. It's like putting a stick of dynamite in a box of Aunt Jemima, right? Yeah. And boom, that's what you saw on 9/11. And really, really have a close look at the video. And it's wonderful that we have all these architects and engineers and explosive experts who've given their testimony and their formulas. That's great. But frankly, we don't need them. Okay?
It's fair.
You really don't. These two towers turned into instant dust. That's explosives. And it completely mimicked the reaction you would see with volcanic events. All right, or controlled demolitions. These buildings were wired and blown to kingdom come. And there's even a third skyscraper, 600 feet tall, that collapsed later that afternoon, World Trade Center 7. Probably 9 out of 10 people don't even know about that, or 19 out of 20 people don't even know about that. It wasn't even struck by a plane. So you can't give that BS story about the plane and the jet fuel for Building 7. What brought that down? So that's what I mean. Just look at data. Shut out all the noise. And there was so much noise at that time on that day. People didn't know what happened. They just turned to the television and they were fed a bunch of lies. And, you know, once that lie got embedded and repeated, now you not only have the authority effect, but since everybody's repeating it, you have the consensus effect, because everybody else believes like you do. So it must be true. But it's not.
It's almost like a mockingbird media type of thing.
Yeah. So, well, they know what they're doing, and they ran very hard with the big lie. And I'll never forget, while the towers are even still standing, hadn't even collapsed yet. I mean, I'm talking about within an hour of the second strike, you had talking heads. They're strategically placed there in the networks saying, well, it's too early to tell, but this has all the earmarks of Osama bin Laden. Oh, really? Oh, you've got it figured out already, don't you? So, but this was the manipulation. And then by the end of the day, these few name droppings turned into a mantra, Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden. And that creates a false reality of its own. And off the war we went for nearly two decades. And those wars would still be going on and expanding had it not been for Donald Trump, who ended everything. So it's still relevant, very important to this day. This isn't that long ago.
So we covered a lot of this stuff on this page. Can you see this page okay, Mike?
Yes, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And I so also, this is
that's my author page. Okay. And
there's the index. I don't know. You just tell me what you want me to do here, because I've got the button to advance everything.
Okay. Well, in the very beginning of this book, I get right to the point, and I name the culprits. So that sort of like frames the whole issue. And then later on, I add the meat to the bone to support what I'm saying. So consider this similar to the opening statement of a prosecutor. And my first quote comes from President Trump. Last year, this is just last year, he said this at a golfing event. He said, nobody has ever gotten to the bottom of 9/11. Oh, really? I thought bin Laden and Al-Qaeda did. No, evidently not, according to President Trump. Nobody has ever gotten to the bottom of 9/11, unfortunately. And they should have, as to the maniacs who did that horrible thing to our city, to our country, and the world. Trump knows the official story is one big lie, and he knows who did 9/11. And when he returns in an official way, I believe this is going to all be revealed to the public. He's given us numerous indicators that he's going to do so. And the people who did it are the same geopolitical forces that have been trying to destroy him ever since he came down the escalator, with all their lies and their fake investigations and constant attacks. Nobody has been attacked more viciously than Donald Trump. And this is why. Not just this issue, but this is who he's aiming at. And this is the bigger picture of things that people need to come to understand. That there is a global mafia that's behind all these events and all of these wars and depressions and revolutions that have plagued humanity for the last 200 centuries. And as Trump and the military now are confronting them directly.
So, Mike, a lot of people are hearing this for the first time. I personally, again, you and I have a lot in common. I refer to Donald Trump today as Commander Trump, and I have reasons for using that assertion. You're one of the few other people that use that term, Commander Trump. We won't go into that now, but he has repeatedly said he's a wartime president.
That's right.
And he's used this term that you use here, he's used the term, he said, this is worse than Pearl Harbor, right? So this is the worst attack since Pearl Harbor. I forget the exact phrase, but that's the essence of it, right? So, but I see what you're doing here. You're making a lot of references to Pearl Harbor because those are so impactful on the psyche, on the normal people just trying to raise a family, go to work, take care of their children, just do their thing. These have a shock effect, and then the repeated messaging gets it to sink in. So once again, the value here is to just pause, to look back and say, wait a minute, was I subjected to some sort of a psychological event, really?
Right. And again, this is what I'm talking about, where the news links to the history. And you have to tie them together in order to obtain a proper understanding of where we are today. Now, you mentioned Pearl Harbor. The big Hollywood blockbuster film of that summer, this is the months preceding 9/11, was Pearl Harbor, starring Ben Affleck, Josh Hartnett. It was so hyped. Everybody heard of the movie. If you didn't see the movie, you certainly saw the trailers or you heard about it. Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor. We were hit over the head with it every day, July, August, right up until the 9/11 event. Okay?
I think you have some pictures. I think I remember seeing pictures in your presentation here.
Yeah, let's see. Pearl Harbor, you can get to the Pearl Harbor references starting on page 21. Okay. So this page here summarizing an article that appeared in November 1998 Foreign Affairs magazine, which is a quarterly official publication of the Council on Foreign Relations. There's a whole history behind that organization, which was founded after World War I. Just put it this way, everybody who's anybody is a member of the CFR. It's invitation only, and they run our foreign policy. They call themselves a study group, a think tank, et cetera. I mean, that is the heart of the American foreign policy establishment. It's part of this geopolitical globalist mafia. And that's exactly what it is. If you're even vaguely familiar with the Cosa Nostra, the mafia, if you've watched the Godfather 1 or Godfather 2 movie or Goodfellas or anything like that, you'll understand the basic dynamics in play here, only exponentially far greater to the 100th degree. It's that simple. It's a mafia. They control governments, central banking, media, academia, any element of society, any sector of society which can influence people. They have got their people at the pinnacle. And they didn't build this overnight. Took a couple centuries.
So, Mike,
relations is a key component of that.
Mike, when people use the words like mafia, and you're from New York, so yeah, I mean you know these things, but when that seems like a very, very big word to use, especially for people who believe in these three letter agencies, the CFR, you know, the World Health Organization, things like that. But you choose your words very specifically. Because mafia has to do with modes, the means, the methods, things like that. You're very specific that this is a mafioso action.
Right. I'm not just throwing that word out there for rhetorical effect. It's a vast organization. It's criminal. Technically, it's legal because they're so powerful, they can define what's legal and what's not legal. But certainly, in terms of a common morality that all decent people share, it is criminal. It's powerful. It's secretive. It's in its most inner sanctums actually involve secret societies, ritualistic weirdness, all kinds of stuff. And it's just big and it's vast. It's what happens when certain group of people get too much money, too much power, and too much free time on their hands, quite frankly.
Right.
What do we do now? Got nothing else left to buy, right? Let's rule the world. And that's what it is. And I've got another book called Crash Course, New World Order, Crash Course NWO, which is probably where people should start. And again, it's less than an hour reading. And you will see how many big people, prominent luminaries from the fields of politics or science or journalism or history, both pro and con, have written and spoken about this global force. Okay, so it's not quote unquote conspiracy theory. That's sure. just a propaganda. It's just a propaganda term. Okay, I bring the receipts. You read my books and you'll understand. I don't care. You might be skeptical and say, "Oh, this guy's a conspiracy theory." Try to refute anything I put in any of my books.
I love that. I love your confidence, and I've read your stuff, and it is bulletproof. I love your position. So how does Pearl Harbor play into the 9/11?
Okay, well, Pearl Harbor, now I don't want to get sidetracked too much into World War II, but the situation in 1941 was this. The American public was 80% opposed to getting involved in a war that was going on in Europe. 80% opposed. It had only been 20 years since the end of World War I, which was a horrific bloodbath. And 150,000 Americans died. Countless thousands more died in later years because they got a whiff of that poison gas and that had after effects. It was just a horrific war, senseless. There was no way that the globalists, through their agent, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was going to be able to get the United States into another world war. 80% opposition. It was very vocal. It was led by people like Charles Lindbergh Jr. There was it was called the Mothers Movement. Millions of mothers were organized and warning against what Roosevelt was trying to do. And his 1940 campaign, he said over and over again, we're not going to send your boys to foreign wars. Don't believe these people, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, they were frantic. They were trying to get involved into the war, especially when the Soviet Union was on the brink of collapse. So the problem that Roosevelt and the globalists above him were facing was the opposition to foreign intervention by the American people. What to do? Well, they began a series of outrageous provocations towards Japan, which was at a defensive alliance with Germany. So in essence, if you can get the war with Japan, you get the war with Germany and go to Europe, and then the Pacific have war on two fronts. So there's a whole story. Again, you know, I don't want to get sidetracked, but I can back all this up. The plan was to deliberately, repeatedly, outrageously provoke Japan and essentially go to war with Japan only on a down low. And just reach a point where Japan says, where their leaders come to the conclusion that war is inevitable. We may as well strike the first blow and gain an early advantage, which is why they struck the naval base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, which was not a state at this time, legitimate military target. And later on, they took Guam, the American base in the Philippines. They chased the British out of Southeast Asia. So in at least in 1942, they had an early advantage. So it was either wait for the war to come to our doorstep or let's expel the Americans and the British from the Pacific sphere and gain an early advantage. American people weren't told this. They just wake up one day, Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. Why those dirty Japs? The next day, millions of American boys, young men, some as young as 16, 17, lying about their age, went to the draft office and signed up. And the anti-war movement, remember, the country was 80% anti-war, disappeared overnight. They shut up. They had to.
So Mike, this seems to be like a pattern of behavior where we Americans kind of go in there and we pique people, we poke them, we kind of like disturb them, we throw them off balance. And here, ultimately, we provoke them to enter a war. Who has the most to gain from this? Like, who has the most to gain here?
Yeah. Well, it's always the same group. There's globalist mafia. Because what came out of World War II, the ashes of World War II, they had it all ready to go. Boom, 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 boom. United Nations, International Monetary Fund, World Health Organization, World Bank, NATO, the CIA, the Foundation of the State of Israel, the European Common Market. It started out as the Benelux nations, then became the European Common Market, ultimately the European Union. You go right down the line. All of the institutions of the, that define the modern world, they were in embryonic form prior to World War II, but they're all set, ready to go, like so many dishes prepared by a chef, and all you have to do is put them in the oven. World War II is the oven. And as soon as that was done, they shoved this new world order down our throats, and everybody accepted it. That was the whole point of World War II.
So this became
World War I, which go together.
This was the catalyst. So what I heard you saying in a previous show was that World War II was an extension. It finished the job that World War I did not do.
Right. That's right.
So the job was to get, I find that it's...
All of the nations, because what came out of World War I? The League of Nations. Everybody, let's join the League and we'll never have such a horrible war again. We won't tell anybody that we started it. It's the equivalent of an arsonist torching your house and then after the fact selling you fire insurance or a fire extinguisher. Hey, you don't want that to happen again, do you? Just like that. So it's World War I and World War II are more like World War Part I and World War Part II.
So to be clear, Mike, on what you just said, because I think it's a very salient point.
Yeah.
A lot of times we Americans... And I'm a former military. We want to believe there were good people doing the right things for the right reason. And generally, we the people are peace-loving. We love. We'll take care of each other. We'll do things for each other. We'll give to our neighbors. But this is not the Americans we're talking about. We're talking about a very specific group of Americans that still exists today, really.
Yes.
So I'm trying to bridge from World War II now. We've identified these patterns of behavior, and now we're going into the future now with these NGOs, these non-governmental organizations that have authority that nobody ever voted for, but they have this unseen charter to kind of control the world. Is that kind of where we're going with this?
Yeah, that's right, because with 9/11, we fast forward to 9/11, same pattern. This was to be the harbinger of World War III. If not a condensed bang-bang war like World War I or II, then maybe a protracted war involving other methodologies. But nonetheless, it was to bring in World War III, and always for the same reason, world government. So World War I brought us the League of Nations by design. World War II brought us the United Nations and all those other globalist institutions by design. And this World War III, which was supposed to be triggered by the new Pearl Harbor of 9/11, was supposed to really finish everything off. And these guys, these articles I'm referencing, Brzezinski, Kristol, Kagan, Ashton Carter, Philip Zelikow, in their own words, the words aren't for us. They're writing amongst their fellow elites, okay, amongst themselves. This is how they talk. They were telling us what was to come out of this post 9/11 world, a consolidated world, the subjugation of Central Asia and the Middle East, a greatly expanded state of Israel. This was the close. New world order.
So, Mike, just for the people out there, like, there's so much confusion just in the general population, because if somebody says that, like I see here, you're literally citing globalism and Zionism, the Zionistic expansion. A lot of people will say, if I speak about this, if I say anything negative about Zionism, that I'm actually being negative against the Jewish people. Can you kind of address that?
Yeah, well, that is one of their most effective self-defense tactics. Okay, because at the core of this global mafia, you have, I mean, it's not exclusively Jewish, but you've had many big time players, mafioso, who were Jewish, like the Rothschild family, the Schiff family, the Warburg family. In more contemporary times, you've got George Soros. There was Bernard Baruch. So there's definitely a disproportionate presence, okay? And, you know, and again, we go back to this, these analogies you can make to the Italian mafia. I remember back in the day when they were going after John Gotti. He had a lawyer, Bruce. He kept insinuating that this is stereotyping of Italian people, trying to make it seem like, oh, you're anti-Italian because you're going.
What's the matter with you?
Yeah. So it's the same game, but they've played it very effectively. Just the mere mention of some of these players or these concepts, they say, oh, anti-Semitism, and that shuts people up. Okay, they had an whole organization dedicated just for this purpose, founded in 1913, the Anti-Defamation League, which for more than 100 years made people tremble. All right, if you start talking one world globalism, they start screaming at you, oh, he's using coded language, dog whistles, anti-Semite. And that just terrifies people. So,
and so if I, Mike, if I remember properly, this concept, this idea that you bring forth was one of the reasons that your bad war got pulled. Or something related to that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. because if you question World War II, if you blow up that narrative, everything else collapses. Okay, and the trick that they use to get a book like that banned is to say it's anti-Semitic, and it's not. I've got Jewish readers. I've had Jewish fans. I mean, they're a small number, you know, but they're there. And I certainly don't condemn a whole race or creed of people. But at the same time, it would be dishonest to write about the Sicilian mafia and not mention that Gotti, Gambino, Genovese, they're all Italian. It'd be ludicrous. And in much the same way, to tippy toe around the fact that many of these big key players are Jewish would be equally kind of dishonest. And I reject the insinuation, and I'm sure people hearing this for the first time, you know, maybe it's a shock to them, but I totally, you know, reject the idea that to mention that the fact that the inner core of this globalist conspiracy has been predominantly a Jewish mafia is somehow anti-Semitic. Why? Is it anti-Hispanic to say the Colombian drug cartel bad? Is it anti-Italian to say John Gotti bad? You know what I'm saying?
Again, we're going into logical fallacies. This is,
yeah,
it's logical.
Yeah, and there've been, and actually when my book was whacked in 2017, it was among one of 25 authors. Okay. And one of the other ones that they went after right away was written by a very well-known Jewish violinist named Gerard Noonan. The title of the book was Tell the Truth, Shame the Devil. Essentially, it was just like the Bad War, and he was just writing about who was behind it and the Jewish world. So he's a Jewish writer, and they kicked him off. So with those fellows, they can't call them anti-Semites. They'll say they're self-hating Jews. So they've got a smear word for everybody, but that has been their most effective tactic. And when you go to 9/11 and you look at the obvious involvement of the Mossad and the gentleman I like to refer to as Bibi Netanyahu, I mean, it's undeniable, but are we supposed to not say that? No.
So in the flip side of that coin then is, you know, like you have on this next page, it's like, this is where they start to roll in the Muslims, right? So now we've got the Zionist Israel good and the bad, big bad Muslims bad, because they needed to kind of start setting that up. Is that where we're going with this?
Well, oh yeah. And that started, that goes way back. There was a terrorist attack. There were terrorist attacks in Israel as far back as 1948, the bombing of the King David Hotel, because at that time it was under British jurisdiction. They they took over Palestine, but then the Jews wanted the British to leave so they could just have a homeland. And to expedite the British departure, they blew up the King David Hotel, which is where the British military was headquartered. And the bombers were actually caught in the act, and a shootout ensued. But they managed to hit the detonators in time and took out a whole wing of the building, killed like, I don't know, 50-something people. But the perps, or the apparent perps, were dressed as Arabs, but they weren't Arabs. It turned out that they were Israelis. There's another precedent in 1955. There were bombings of U.S. and British property, and it was a big conspiracy. It was about to, they were about to undertake large-scale bombings of American targets and even American people throughout the Middle East. The Egyptians blew up the conspiracy, and it turned out that they were Israelis impersonating Arabs. So you have precedent for this. It's called false flag operations.
So I don't
go way back, yeah.
So thank you for clarifying that, Mike. So we have these false flags, and the idea of a false flag is simply for something. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. It means that whoever's being blamed, what maybe it wasn't the party, that type of thing. But I see this happening here. You mentioned this beginning with the OSS, World War II. But then at some point we had legislation, and I'm not going to pretend to know all that, but there was legislation that said we can, and this is probably Obama's first term, but basically that said we can start using money, federal taxpayer money, to not only just use these methods overseas, but we can use these methods against Americans too. Am I jumping the gun on something? Or is this
that's correct. I mean, now the Mossad, they do whatever they do in any country they want. The CIA, when they do these psychological manipulation operations, they were limited to doing it overseas. Okay, they tweaked the law. So now you can interpret that law so that they can do them here as well. And this is something else people need to wrap their heads around. And again, the incredulity fallacy starts to kick in. And that's where you have to pause and just ask yourself, is it possible?
Right.
If it seems very unlikely, unreasonable, forget that. Is it possible? And if it is possible, then you have to open your mind to it. Now, think back to the old Mission Impossible TV show back in the day with Peter Graves and Leonard Nimoy, and then a more recent iteration with Tom Cruise, et cetera. Look at the creative scams that they were pulling off, the psychological operations in these TV shows. You're talking people wearing masks to pretend they're somebody else, committing false flag terror attacks, all these scripted events. And, you look at that on TV or in a theater and you think, boy, that's very clever. And you're just entertaining yourself watching a film, right? No, that's based on the way things really are. And Hollywood and CIA have been incestuous since the establishment of CIA, since the OSS. Hollywood people sent people over World War II. They worked with the OSS to run psychological operations. So this notion of false flags and operatives and penetration of the media to put out phony stories, anything you've seen in the Mission Impossible TV series or the movie is actually reality. It truly is. Where do you think they got it from?
So. Right. So I don't want to take you off track on what you're doing because this is really good stuff, but I also want to honor your time commitment because
I have a little more time.
So there's so much stuff. I think we have like 79 pages in this and we just showed a few, but if you would direct me, where do you want to take this conversation? Because we're opening up these doors for people that they didn't ever hear before. The idea that our government, like we didn't talk, I don't know if it's in your document, but like Operation Northwoods.
Right.
No, this is something that nobody knows about. Like, what is that? Can you address some of the we don't have to stay in World War II. We can just go throughout the history where either the U.S. was provoked into doing something or we provoked somebody else into doing something.
Yeah.
And how Operation Northwoods would have factored into that.
Well, there's such a long precedent of it. And this is also part of the logical mix. Precedent. Always ask yourself, is there a precedent for this crazy idea that you're putting forth? Because if there is, it doesn't mean that the thing you're evaluating today is necessarily the way you say it is, but it proves that it's possible because it's been done before. Okay? Once somebody has done something, you have to assume that, well, you know they're capable, what they're capable of, so that you naturally assume that they might do it again. So that opens your mind to it. So let's look at just a few.
Sure. Just tell me what page to go to.
Historical precedents. You mentioned this. This is not in the book, but let's talk about our Operation Northwoods. And there's many more you could talk about, actually. But this one in particular and some other ones I think are especially useful because they're now acknowledged by official historians, respectable historians. If you don't want to believe Nutty Mike King, hey, the guy at Princeton is going to tell you exactly what I'm telling you right now. Operation Northwoods was declassified, I don't know when, maybe the 1990s, not too long ago.
Right.
You can see the actual document online. This is an actual fact. President John F. Kennedy was presented with a plan put together by Lyman Lemnitzer, who was he was head of the Pentagon at the time. And it called for starting a war with Cuba, which at that time would probably have meant war with Russia, because that's what these psychos wanted. They wanted the World War III to finish the job even back then.
So
World War II didn't even finish the job.
But Mike, what is the job? Like, what is the job?
The job is the final consolidation of the countries, either through conquest or consent, into a single world government system.
So, world government. So this involves fooling people.
Right.
Lying, cheating, stealing, fooling people, getting them to acquiesce based on a false pretense, pretty much.
Right. Like for it involved advancing this agenda through multiple false pretexts and fronts, such as global warming. We're all going to die. The ice caps are going to melt. Unless if you let us tax you more and take over private enterprise and do away with national sovereignty, then we could save the planet. You see how the trick works?
Yeah, it's all about...
There's always a crisis. COVID, we operated under WHO, World Health Organization guidelines, which grew out of World War II. Okay? Everybody had to agree to obey the WHO. So, but that's the end game. A one world consolidated. And you know, you still might have the illusion of countries. Okay? But nobody retains their true freedom or independence. Everybody is acquiescing to the dictates of the New World Order, the top of the pyramid. So that's what I mean by finishing the job.
And so for
and
those
something
of you,
like a World War III event, that would really expedite it. Because wars have a way of, out of...
Which is what we're trying to avoid.
Right, yeah. Right.
Because everyone knows that if we get Americans to fight each other, or these big behemoth countries with big weapons to fight each other,
right.
It's the Hegelian dialect. Dialectic. It's like we can. There's this problem that we caused, but we're going to come in and save you because we have.
That's right. So that's what I mean by as far back as 1960, they wanted that World War III scenario. So they presented this document to Kennedy, and what the plan entailed. Again, this is all declassified. This isn't conspiracy theory anymore. They had in place a plan to stage false flag attacks down in Miami and blame it on Castro, then go into Cuba and start a war in Cuba, which was backed up by the Soviet Union. Kennedy not only, he basically threw it in the trash, he fired Lemnitzer, and then he fired Alan Dulles too, who was the head of the CIA. And there's a whole litany of things that JFK did that are not part of the agenda. And like so many others, he paid the price for it. Yeah, lone gunman. Okay. So that's, but anyway, that's important because, again, it's declassified and it is now accepted by the official high priests of academia, Operation Northwoods. The trick is they don't talk about it.
And that's why.
Right, but they don't talk about it. But when you see a precedent like this, now you start to say, my God, what else have they done?
Well, and this is the point of this conversation, is to bring these to light, to bring these out in the open. Because if somebody has gone since the Bay of Pigs all the way till now, not knowing about Operation Northwoods, and the first time they're hearing from it is from Tia Julie and Mike.
Yeah.
We got some catching up to do.
Yeah.
And your books are going to do that. So you've touched on so many of these things. Yeah. We're at a little over an hour and we're at 23 years after 9/11. Yeah. What are some of the more compelling points that you make in your book? Because I think my hope is that everyone listening to this buys at least one of your books, this one or the New World Order book, or even Bad Wars. Like, just if they taste just one of your books, they're going to want the rest.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
But what are some of the points that, I mean, I can bring up the document again if you have pages you want me to point to.
Oh, no, just off my head. I mean, there's so many. And frankly, my purpose, I wanted to really put something together that could be read in under an hour. And to achieve that, I had to leave out so much good stuff. There are so many points that just destroy the official story of 9/11. It's just incredible.
So maybe
if I had to start with the most compelling data point, which really grabs people's attention as a starter, it would be the controlled demolition of World Trade Center number 7.
Number 7. What page is that approximately? Do you know?
Let me see. I got to look it up right here.
Oh, there's 7 right there. It's page 39, it looks like.
Yeah, page 39.
So tell us.
That means the impossible collapse of a third skyscraper on 9/11.
So before you go into this, Mike, would you please kind of dovetail in references to where important documents were stored, both here and in the Pentagon? Because the day prior to 9/11, something hit the news about missing money from the Department of Defense. Yeah. And so that just, all of that disappeared. The news disappeared because it was trumped by 9/11. But also, where was the money, the information regarding all of the transactions, where was that held?
Well, in terms of the Pentagon, it was a wing. My understanding is the section of the Pentagon which was destroyed had to do with accounting and auditing. And Donald Rumsfeld had just said that they couldn't account for $10 trillion. So that would be a nice little ancillary benefit of 9/11. Let's, you know, in addition to the drama of taking these two towers out, traumatizing the public and marching us off to war, let's throw in some side deals and accomplish some stuff. Let's get rid of this important paperwork. It's also said there was important stuff at Building 7. Larry Silverstein, the leaseholder, he loaded the towers up with insurance. He ended up collecting double indemnity. He called it two different catastrophic events, each plane. So he ended up doubling up. So he made a fortune on that day. So lots of money was made on that day. There's missing gold from the basement of the tower. But these were not motives. These were just like add-ins. The motive was to have that spectacle of the towers blowing up, ingrain that in people's mind, traumatize them, emotionalize them, feed them a pack of lies. They're already vulnerable to media lies, but in this traumatized condition, they're super vulnerable. Now you start to get into almost a form of hypnosis and then march the country off to war. Okay. But Building 7, it's a great icebreaker. There's so many other powerful proofs to destroy the official story. But this one is an icebreaker because how many people, like I said earlier, how many people even know about it? A third skyscraper over 600 feet tall later that afternoon, straight down at free fall speed, right into its own footprint. Identical to a controlled demolition where every support point fails at the precise same time. Okay, you'd have to have professionals to rig this to fall like that, rig it in advance, and it would take weeks. But you can see the video. You can go do a Google video search for World Trade 7 collapse, and you'll see it. And it was not even hit by a plane. It wasn't even part of the World Trade Center. They call it World Trade Center 7. It's actually outside of the center and across the street. And it just collapsed into its own footprint, not being struck by anything. Nobody can explain that. They didn't even mention it in the 9/11 Commission report. Let's all pretend it doesn't exist. So
I also recall that one of the reporters, it was like one of the major network reporters, was literally sitting there speaking about the fall of World Trade Center 7, but it was still behind her. Do you remember seeing something like that?
That's right. That was a British reporter. That was BBC. So evidently she's not too familiar with New York. She's on there. You see this on a video as well. It's still around there. And she's announcing, we've just received word that the Solomon Brothers building has collapsed. That was the original name of it. And she's doing her report. And there it is, over her shoulder, standing as strong as ever. So what happens when you have these type of operations, things might get a little out of sync. And somebody jumped the gun. And she reported on the collapse before it actually happened.
There's probably the time change or something like that. So you touched upon Larry Silverstein briefly. Now, to criticize him might be fall into that category of you're criticizing the Jewish people, but he's not Jewish in terms, maybe he is, maybe he's not, in terms of the religious sense. This is more of the political activist.
The mafia sense,
Okay. So this is what you have in your report.
That's right. He owned the lease for World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. And it's interesting. There are about a dozen buildings equidistant from the two towers, okay, on the four streets surrounding the World Trade Center, Liberty, Vesey, forget the names. Right. Only his other leased building, 7, collapsed. The other 11 did not. So, but certainly he would have been in a position to enable professionals to access the building and do what had to be done. Now, but there's much more to that leads one to suspect that he is one of the culprits. He had a long background. He was very close to Israeli prime ministers, especially Bibi Netanyahu. And I reproduce an excerpt from an article from Haaretz, which is one of the major news services of Israel, and explains right in there, this is like a few years later, how he spoke every Sunday, without exception, on the phone with Bibi Netanyahu. Really? What are you talking about? I mean, I don't know. I'm lucky if I talk to my guy friends once every 3 months. You know, hey, how you been? Good. And you know, what are they talking about? They spoke with Netanyahu. He's a big-time Israeli expansionist Zionist. He was besties with Bibi Netanyahu. That's right in Haaretz's article. Now, Mr. Silverstein had breakfast. And again, and I love doing this. This is one of my signature moves. I take, whenever I can, I get data from mainstream media. Because then nobody could say, oh, where'd you get that from? Okay, this is known as testimony against interest. So even though the mainstream media is dishonest, if they're giving you something that contradicts their own narrative, you can kind of hang them with it. So this is all mainstream news. This Haaretz piece where he says he was very close with Netanyahu and they spoke every Sunday. We also come to find out that he had breakfast every morning at Windows of the World, which is the tippy top of the North Tower, the World Trade Center restaurant. Okay. That particular Tuesday, he wasn't there. And it was later reported, and you can see him on film. He's in an interview. He says, I was on my way to work, and my wife reminded me I had an appointment with the dermatologist. And I said, oh, I can't today, honey. But she put her foot down. No, you're going to go to that doctor's appointment. Oh, how lucky for him. All right. So he was with these people the day before, knowing he was going to kill them. All right. And then the next day, he doesn't show up. Now, that's one. He has two children, Roger and Lisa, who also worked in the tower. And again, this is confirmed. They could show you Israeli papers, Wall Street Journal. They were also supposed to be there that day. They were both running late. So Papa Silverstein, Lisa Silverstein, Roger Silverstein should all have died that day. They all would meet up at Windows of the World. They were all absent that day. Okay? So now you start to get into the laws of probabilities.
Right.
It defies the law of probability that all three of them should be so lucky that day. And there he is, Lucky Larry Silverstein, who later collected, he made a fortune because he demanded, I got to get paid twice. It's two separate events. That, and he did. He did indeed make a fortune that day.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, it's mathematically impossible. Like,
yeah,
it's not logical, and it's also not mathematically possible. So, yeah. Well, I find this to be very compelling. I hope
you're listening to this. Before we wrap up, I should also mention Zim, which is in line with R. If you go backwards, I think Zim is before Larry. No, maybe not. Where is Zim?
I got it.
That would be page 31. There you go. Zim Navigation, you've probably at one time or another seen their there are trailers on the highway. You see that logo, ZIM. Stars of David. That's the ninth largest shipping company in the world. It's a 50-50 private and public. Israeli government owns a big chunk of it too. Okay, so it's huge. They broke their lease. They had offices in the World Trade Center. They broke their lease and moved out of there 3 weeks before the attacks. They relocated to Virginia. And a spokesman for the company, I quote him in there, again, mainstream media. He says, when we saw the attacks, we felt so lucky. Same word that Larry Silverstein used, because our offices were run out of there. We moved to Virginia as a cost-saving measure. Ninth largest shipping company in the world. And evidently, they couldn't afford the rent anymore in New York, so they moved to Virginia. So, and so they all survived. So again, we go back to that laws of probability thing. So Zim was out of there. Larry Silverstein wasn't there. Roger Silverstein wasn't there. Lisa Silverstein wasn't there. This is called pattern recognition. I've been doing this since I was a kid. Okay. This is a mathematical impossibility, and there's more. Oh, many more.
Right. I'm going to go to the last page because it does have some information about that's relevant to people that get a hold of you. It shows your website, which is realnewsandhistory.com. Does that remain the best way to reach you?
Folks should go there. There's a ton of free content. And you see images there of all my books I've written all over the years. And they're all the same. Clear, concise, lots of pictures. Captions, I simplify. I don't complicate. It gets you right to the truth. Liars obfuscate. Truth to others, keep it simple. Okay? So you go to realnewsandhistory.com, bookmark it. You can get on the mailing list. You can sign up to get on the mailing list there. You'll see that. And then there's a section called books and PDFs where you'll find all the books and PDFs. If someone wants to pick up these two, though, the Crash Course 9/11 or the Crash Course NWO, I would ask that they get those two at Amazon, though, just so we could, have an effect on the search engine. This way, more newbies will stumble across it. So
I know a lot of people are probably looking at this and say, wait a minute, Earth Angel Media, why are we talking about this hideous stuff? Studio 17, why are you talking about all of this, these lies and these deceits again? Yeah. Because we don't want to repeat this. We want to hold the people accountable that need to be held accountable. And Larry, Mike, you're doing such a service. I'm meeting with Larry King tomorrow. He's got a podcast. That was Freudian slip. But you're doing such a service. You've also got a bundle. So first of all, no brainer on the email list. It's free. People can go to your website and just sign up, and they get stuff every day. And it's great stuff. But beyond that, you've got this bundle of PDFs. So if they want to get the book, go to Amazon. But how does the PDF thing work?
Well, there's on the menu at the website, realnewsandhistory.com, you'll see one page is titled Books and PDFs. So all my books are available there in paperback form or the PDF bundle. You get them all as PDFs. 31 books for $29 is a steal.
It's less than a dollar a book. It's like no brainer.
I mean, it's more, it's like multiple college curriculums, the amount of knowledge that you'll obtain, but more importantly, retain, because of the way I present it, it really sticks, you know?
And I'm going to put the links in the show notes so people can just click on it and go there. But Larry, before we wrap up, you know, clearly you're advanced in terms of the detective work and things like that.
Yeah.
And I'm just getting people to ask questions. What advice would you have to really anybody? Yes, get the books. Yes, get the email. But just in terms of life in general, just living life, how do we teach people to become more discerning? Like, do you have any advice or guidelines?
That's, I hate to be negative. This sounds negative, but it's not. It's just realistic. Everything, there seems to be offsetting balances of like good, evil, truth, lies. And the good people have a tendency to think that everyone else is like them, and they're not. And especially as you get higher up into the hierarchy of power in society. And there's a reason for that, because when you're people who are like super ambitious and would sell their own mothers to gain advantage in society, they have an advantage. They're more likely to gravitate into the higher positions. And that's a critical dynamic to understand, because you can't assess people in high positions of power the way you might assess your own peers, let's say. In other words, you're going to find a vastly disproportionate number of psychopaths at the pinnacles of positions in society. And that could be in the corporate world, that could be in academia, that could be in journalism. And that's just the way it is. That may sound cynical, but it's not. I wrote a piece once called Basketball Players and Political Psychopaths. Okay, well, how would the two relate? And my point was, we don't often come across men who are 6'8", 6'9", 6'10", 7 foot. When you do, it's like freak show, right? But if you go to an NBA basketball game, you go down the floor, the shorties are 6'5". Okay? Everybody's 6'7", 8", 9", 10", 7 foot, even the coaches, because they're ex-players. So what's going on here? Is that a coincidence? No. It's because their height conferred upon them a certain advantage. They're closer to the rim. It's easier for them to score. Duh. Okay? Similarly, if the psychopathic tendency to always get ahead and go up, 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 more money, more power, if you have that in you, you have an advantage over other people. Right? A degenerate liar is more likely to get elected to high office than the honest man. Okay? He's more likely to rise in various fields and professions than the honest man. It doesn't mean that they're all bad. The point I'm trying to say is you're going to find a really weird number of 7-footers up there in the pinnacle of society. And once you understand that, and that's just pure, plain, basic logic. Okay, if you understand the basketball analogy, So I think once people understand that, they'll start to get away from this instinctive reaction to any talk about conspiracies as crazy. It's not. It's actually throughout history. You go back to ancient times. It's almost standard operating procedure. And I'll leave you with this quote by Edward Gibbon, British historians in the 18th century. He wrote basically an entire encyclopedia on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. But he observed, and this struck me so much, like I wrote it down and kept it on a card. It says, history is the official register of the crimes and follies of mankind. And it truly is. You go back in history and you look at what governments and political leaders have done throughout history. It's always folly or crimes, and the two often go together. That's the norm. So understand that and start looking at the people that too many of us tend to worship in a different light. A lot of them are very bad people.
So I want to wrap up, Mike, with this, because there's so much negative out there right now.
Yeah.
Knowing what I know and knowing what I see, I'm more excited now about the future than I have been in a long time. I feel like we have this air superiority, to use a military term, but
yeah.
I feel like we have MiG cover, and there's a lot of reasons we can talk another time about that, but I'm very excited about going into next year, especially through June, July of next year. For a lot of reasons, I feel like there's this consciousness that, like, we don't need to be dropping bombs on people we don't know. We don't need these endless wars. We don't need to hate people who are different than us. Like, but those are my feelings. Like, what are your feelings about looking ahead? I'm not looking for dates or events. I'm just saying, yeah, just in general, what are you feeling?
Well, the good news is that I'm not the only one who's been aware of what these bad people have been up to. The U.S. military has known this stuff for a long time, and they have taken measures to deal with these people once and for all, and that's a whole other story. So I, too, am optimistic. There is a military operation that's going on right now, which is just so vast and mind-blowing in scope.
So, Mike, you're teasing us for the next time, but yeah, let's be the U.S. military working in isolation, or do we have some help? I mean, because we've been the bad people. We've been the bad guys, like, for so long. Are we just doing this as a part of a, we're not, are we, is there anyone helping us?
Yeah, well, you know, the world became so interconnected, mainly as a result of this mafia guy. But, you know, those connections do not necessarily have to be for the bad. So militaries communicate with each other. So this is a worldwide operation that's going on.
And I think we'll leave there. That's going to be the cliffhanger for something. Yeah. In the future. So yeah. Mike, you know, I had 50 people on my list. Thankfully I got a hold of you through a friend, and I couldn't think of a better way to launch Studio 17. I just love you, and I appreciate what you're doing. And thank you so much for being our guest on the first episode. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This episode of Studio 17 is sponsored by Pure. Optimize your life by taking your health to the next level. Pure is an American-based, Amazon-like distribution system of online portals that give discounted access to clean, potent, natural, and ethically sourced healthy solutions for fat loss, muscle gain, immaculate skincare, immune system support, whole body cleanse, physiological balance, and performance support for athletes of all ages. With very deep financial backing, Pure provides access to more than just its own brand. Pure regularly handpicks the best products and nutrients from world-class companies to add to their quickly growing wellness lineup that now includes Korean skincare, medical-grade nutraceuticals that are listed as pharmaceutical alternatives in the physician's desk reference, and healthy coffee that rivals the world's best brews, but for only about a dollar per cup. Studio 17 listeners in search of the gateway to vitality, youth, beauty, and better health can get 25% off retail by visiting livepure.com/gateway and signing up for free as a preferred customer. Meanwhile, if you are a content creator, influencer, or home-based entrepreneur looking for worldwide cash flows from the emerging gig economy, Pure's state-of-the-industry brand partner affiliate program can bring you up to 7 different payment vectors as bonuses. Brand partner affiliate signup is free through the end of September 2024 and includes a cutting-edge website that is personally branded to you or to your business. Sign up as a brand partner at livepure.com/affiliate. Thank you for visiting Studio 17 today. Remember to question everything. Rinse. Repeat. Please share freely and share often. We'll be right back.